Hi, and welcome to The Chat. My name is Leah Tsamaglou. Each week on The Chat, we shine a light on the lives and careers of UTS alumni here at the 2SER studios. This week, my guest on the show is Zenny Edwards. Zenny is an architectural historian and the director of the United Nations of Australia Peace Program. Let's listen to her story.
I arrived in Sydney from the Philippines in 1974, and before that, I was a copywriter in the Philippines, and I worked for a publication in Sydney, and my employer wanted me to work for him here. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I was headhunted to work for his publishing company here.
What was the publishing company?
It published children's books,
yep,
and general books and large print books. It was also an agent for quite a few other publishing companies overseas, like in England, Ulvis Croft, and in New York as well. So my employer applied for my permanent resident visa, mm-hmm, and that's how I started. That's how I came to Sydney.
How did you move into the world of
architectural history?
Architectural history, exactly.
It's a long and winding road in a way.
Let's start.
I worked for the publishing company called Magman International, Magazine Management International, mm-hmm, and for 3 years, and then I met my would-be husband. So I moved applied for a job at the Angus and Robertson Publishers. So I got that job with Richard Walsh. So that was the turning point in my career, I think, because Angus and Robertson Publishers had the best Australian list of all. They had the best known authors and all. That's how I learned about Australia and Australian history. So I stayed with Angus and Robertson Publishers for 3 years, and then we started a family. So I quit my job, because I was the only one here and I didn't have any family. I quit my job and I thought, you know, what would I do with myself with a little baby? So we moved to St. Ives, which had a beautiful garden. And that's how I started getting interested in gardens and plants and all that. And I thought, that's one thing I can do in the house. We built a greenhouse and I started collecting plants. And I thought I would concentrate on something that has never been done before. So I concentrated on colonial plants that were grown in Australia during the colonial times, the original plants,
wow,
not the hybrids. So
what made you interested in those particular plants?
I don't know. I think it was just a curiosity on my part to sort of learn more about Australia. So I did that, and I started collecting plants in such a way that the old plants that I collected became well known to other collectors and other, I call it, heritage properties, who asked me to supply them with the original plants that I've managed to collect. So I did, and I supplied them, and the colonial plants were grown in colonial gardens and heritage gardens, and the heritage gardens were part of the heritage houses, and that's how I started. I started that from plants to gardens to houses.
Wow, what sort of resources were around back then for, like, those colonial plants?
Not a lot.
How did you get those seeds? How did you get it? Would have been the Botanical Gardens Trust?
Yes, the Royal Botanic Gardens, the Mitchell Library. The Mitchell Library at the State Library is rich. If you go into their archive, you will find the first plants that were grown by MacArthur and Joseph Banks and all of that. They're all in Parramatta, and there's quite a list of them. And you just go and research that, and then you just go back and back and back.
How fascinating. And then so from that, then you studied at UTS a doctorate in architectural history when you graduated in 2006.
Six, very late.
Yeah. Why did you decide to study? Why did you want to study after working in it for so long?
It's another interesting story. I've always lived in the Upper North Shore of Sydney. from the time I arrived from the Philippines. I lived in Water Street, and then we lived in, we had a stint in Harbor or Freshwater, which it's called now. It's a bit of an upmarket term, I think. And then we moved to St. Ives, and we bought a house with the children. And then we moved to Tarahumara. And coming from the Philippines, I had a BA, a Bachelor of Arts. And I thought I'd like to do some more study because my children were also doing quite a lot of studies already. And because I became the president of the National Trust, I thought I'd go into architectural history. That's how I did that. My main subject was John Suhlman, whose house happened to be near my house, Ingelholm, a few blocks down my street. So I chose him as my subject.
I actually had a question about the particular. You have chosen, a lot of your publications have focused around the north and upper north shore of Sydney. So you've obviously looked at Ku-ring-gai, Gordon, Warrawee. What is it about this area that has attracted you with architecturally, I guess?
It's very rich.
Yeah.
It's a combination of gardens. It's actually a garden suburb, I call it, because the houses are on big allotments, and they're surrounded by trees. And all the houses, most of the houses then, not now, I think because of the development going on, were designed by well-known architects. It was an enclave of desirable residences by the upper middle class, I think, mainly because they can go to the country in quotation marks 5 minutes from the city. So that's where everybody went, and it had a progress association that was very strict in saying regulating the development. The trees must be grown, street plantings, and all that. They were very strict, so there was a cohesive quality about the whole suburb.
So until it seemed now. So it seemed very organized as well, the way that the councils were set up as well, and how
The Progress Association were the precursor of the local councils, and that started in Warunga, which is the garden village of the Upper North Shore. And that's how the councils started in 1906. It's all very... And John Suhlman was also a determining sort of character in that.
What sorts of architects would we know from that area that would be well known? Who's designed some iconic...
Well, from the most modern is Harry Seidler.
Mm. Wow.
So he designed the Rose Seidler House, which,
a
group of three houses in that, and it's in the bush. Yeah. So that was really a sort of a break from the norm, and it was really criticized by everybody, saying, but it is a lovely thing. Now, one of my examiners from England came, and I came from England, and I went around and gave him a tour, and he was jumping like a little kid, and he said, my goodness, this was built in 1950 or 1951. It looks like it was built yesterday. So that's the quality of architecture. It's timeless. Glenn Murcutt, is he there? William Hardy Wilson is there, which his house, the first design that he built was a maidless, the first one. And it was also criticized by everybody, saying it looked like a tram shed or something like that. So B.J. Waterhouse, Vernon, who was a colonial architect, quite a few from the modern to the very early architects, and the obscure ones who were just as good.
Of course. Do you have a favorite era in architecture?
Probably the Edwardian.
Edwardian, yeah. Why is that?
Because it was a freer style from the Victorian.
It's just as ornate, right?
It's more, I think, more mindful.
Yeah.
It's more functional in a way that it was thinking more about the function rather than the design. but it was still very livable in a way. It was a sort of an Edwardian arts and crafts, sort of mingling of the two.
Why do you think it's important for us to maintain our built and cultural heritage in Australia?
Because it gives us a glimpse of the past and where we came from and where we are heading. And because the architecture that was designed then were designed for a specific purpose, for a family. And it was a dream. Australian dream is owning your own house in a little block. That was the Australian dream. And I think it is still the dream now, although the mores of the times is changing, maybe because of the demands for space and the money side of it determines what happens. It's just how you lived, I think, is very important. And the architects were then very mindful of that. They were designing for the people and for their clients rather than for themselves.
Yeah, particularly in the North Shore, and I guess also in the city at times. Do you see heritage as a notion and as a part of our lexicon, a fairly new term? How long has the notion of heritage listing been in Australia? Because it's relatively new, otherwise we'd have like workers' cottages everywhere in, you know, the city, and things wouldn't have been knocked down over time.
Heritage is an intangible word, isn't it, when you think about it?
It's
how you view things and it's how you value things. Some councils are better at it than others. The lure of the money, prospect of it, determines what decisions are made. But heritage to me is an intrinsic value of a place. You can't take it away. Even if you demolish the houses, it's documented in the past, and it's documented in the collective memory of the people that live there and the people who have worked there. So in a way, heritage is really, you know, preserving our past for the future, and trying to learn from it and do better. I'm not against demolishing heritage houses, and people say, oh, well, heritage is heritage, you know, you have to move on. But it's not that. It's preserving what is valuable. That's why we have conservation places where there is an intact group of housing that really tells a story of what that locality was and should be kept.
Do we have a distinct architectural style in Sydney? Can you say, or it's a bit of a mishmash?
It's a bit of a mishmash, but that's the beauty of it, because Australia is a multicultural. So what you think and what you feel is Australian is up to you. There is no federation style. Everybody says it's a federation. What is a federation style? There is no federation style. It's a federation period. Houses that were built during the federation period, which is also a mix of California bungalow, things architects have gleaned from America, from England and from France. But there is no federation style. And to me, there is no Australian style. The homestead, people say that's an Australian style, and there are quite a few homesteads in Tarramarra, which are beautiful. That's Australian. But then so is a California bungalow that has been done.
What about the Queenslander?
The Queenslander is a beautiful style, isn't it? So it was built for a purpose, to let the air through and natural ventilation and all of that. So that was really quite a beautiful style. So architecture that designs for its environment in context is what an Australian style should be. So the Queenslander is a Queenslander. Harry Seidler designed his house in Killara, and what he did is he inserted it into the bush. He just didn't destroy everything. He just inserted it, and it really blends very well. It's very modern. It's very brutalist. But it fits, and there is no sort of clash of natural and built environment in it. So is Glen Market the same thing?
As a heritage consultant, what are some of the projects that you've consulted on? Do you focus mainly on residential buildings or commercial or both?
I focus mainly on residential buildings. I've been asked to do heritage impact statements. Mm-hmm. If development is being built next to a heritage house, for example, or an old house, I go and talk about the history of not just the house but the whole place.
And what does that entail?
It's mainly doing a lot of history.
Yeah.
And I go back to the Aboriginal history as well, which I think is very, very important.
Mm.
And to make sure that whatever development is respects that. Although some of the best developments are really the opposite of the colonial, which I think is also the opposite of what that style of the house is. I really am against pseudo-federation copying the old. If you're going to do something, go and do something modern with respecting whatever it is alongside it, because I think that's the way to go.
You're listening to The Chat on 2SER 107.3. My name is Leah Tsumoglu, and I'm talking to architectural historian and the director of the United Nations of Australia Peace Program, Zenny Edwards. Moving on to the work that you're currently doing for the United Nations of Australia, what led you to get involved with human rights and working for the UN?
I myself question myself. Sometimes in the middle of the night when things are going so bad with the world and the terrorism, and I said, what am I doing here, you know? I was the president of the National Trust before I became involved in the UN. And I became president of the National Trust when I just finished my PhD. And I said, I really needed a break. And they said, no, well, we will nominate you for the National Trust. And then I became the president of the National Trust. So I stayed in 2008. And then I said, I really must have a break. And then I was asked to sort of say, nominate for the UN Women. And I said, well, I don't know anything about the United Nations. That wasn't really my area of even interest. Expertise. I know the United Nations, everybody knew it, and I liked what they were doing and all, but I really wasn't directly involved in it. So they said, well, come to the AGM. And I did. And someone nominated me for the committee. And then someone nominated me to be the chair. And there was another person that nominated to be a chair. And then she withdrew. So by default, I became the chair of UN Women of New South Wales chapter. So that was the eye opener for me, and I thought there's really something in this. Women empowerment and gender equality was our main focus, and there was really a need. And so I stayed with them, and then they became nationalized in a way that all the divisions were. So we left that. I did a stint with them, and then I was asked to nominate for the UNA, which is the United Nations Association of Australia. It's under the WIFUNA, which is the World Federation of United Nations Associations. So there have been United Nations Associations everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So this was the Australian part. And so I said, well, I will go. Maybe I should learn more about the United Nations in a way that it's a broader concept, the UNAA. So I went to the UNAA. I became part of the committee, the executive committee. And then I thought, this is too broad. I really want to do something. So I said, I'll concentrate to the UNA peace program because I want to promote peace. So I did. And there was so much interest in it, and I applied for grants and sponsorships, and everybody came to sort of say, well, this is a good thing. Trying to promote peace, which is as intangible as heritage. It's something. But what we did is we did small things. Like with International Day of Peace, it's 21st of September. We distributed red roses. We distributed peace flags. We released peace doves. We had interfaith services, Parramatta, which had a service from with religions ranging from A to Z. So it ranged from the Aboriginal concept of religion to Zoroastrianism.
Oh, wow.
So it just went on in the 4 to 2 hours, that service. It was beautiful, really, really gorgeous. So that the peace program, in a way, became very big. So it became national.
I wanted to ask you about that. So, yeah, like you mentioned, World Peace Day is on September the 21st. How important is world peace in our current world climate to you?
Yes, it is important, isn't it? As I said, I wake up in the middle of the night and say, what am I doing here? You know, we seem to be going backwards rather than forwards. We are optimistic. It's one step at a time. You go inch by inch, trying to sort of get there. And if I can convince one person to sort of say, yes, this is worthwhile doing, then it's worthwhile doing. And that's the main thing. It's the optimism that we, in the human race, that we believe in, whether this is the biggest obstacle we have encountered so far, mainly because we don't have a world leader that we can look up to. We don't. It's one of those things that problems that will make, if we can solve it, it will make things easier. But the world leaders are failing us at the moment. So that makes it doubly difficult. So it's up to the ordinary citizens, I think, to do their thing, and that's what's happening. I think the ordinary become global citizens rather than just being an American citizen or being an Australian citizen. You become a global citizen and you become responsible for each other. So I think that's what we believe, we're one big human family. It's a big concept, isn't it? It's a big idea.
It is. Are there sorts of concrete goals that you've sort of set, I guess, on a worldwide scale?
We have the Sustainable Development Goals.
That's why I was going to ask you about that, actually.
Which is the 17 goals. From climate change to poverty to women empowerment to gender equality to health to just development, resilient cities, you name it.
And it's a worldwide thing, isn't it?
It's the UN worldwide thing. So I'm wearing that pin.
Oh, lovely.
So it's, but then the underlying base of that is peace.
Yeah.
So you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
So it's the cause and effect of what you do.
Who do you consult with on a local level? Do you consult with our politicians and that sort of thing? Is that a big question? Do you want to?
We want to, but we never get any response. We are a very small, my committee is 4. And we make decisions on the spot. And that's the beauty of having a small committee, because if we have a big committee, we just can't. And sometimes the opportunity arrives and we have to make a decision. The government has given us some support. In the past, the multicultural minister, the former multicultural minister, John Ajaka, attended one of our events, which was the Auburn's AFL team, which was mostly the Muslim team, and they were playing, and we said we would support them, and we invited him, and we released the peace doves because it was the day for cultural diversity and development, and he said in Lebanon when we release those doves they'll shoot them down and kill them. So he was so impressed with what we did. The next morning, his assistant called us up and said, "We would like to support you." And that's how it started. So anyway, the government was very good to us. We apply for grants as well with councils. Parramatta Council is one of our biggest supporters because we chose Western Sydney as our main focus. That's where the problem lies with the way multicultural, it's not a problem, it's mainly just reaching out to the multicultural communities there. We have had anti-bullying forums with the students because there's nothing better than students talking amongst themselves. So that's how we would like to continue that if we can. Our grant monies have run out, so we're looking for some money for that. The young is where we're going. We learn a lot from them. And they're the voice of the worries and the problems that that their future is presenting to them, and they take it very seriously. And at the moment, they sort of it's very difficult to express in a way that they're not criticized or they're not laughed up. Or they're not being heard because they're young. To us, that's very important, and we're trying to reach them in a way, sort of that they can understand and empathize with, and not being talked down to or whatever. That's why we hold student forums.
So some of your long-term visions are focused on youth.
Always,
yeah.
Always, whether it's you know, ringing the bells or doing yoga on Yoga Day or distributing peace flags or distributing red roses on Friendship Day. You know, we give them red roses, give that to your friend and say, you know, I respect you. Or giving chocolates to give to their parents on World Parents Day. I mean, it's simple things. Mm. It's just teaching them the value of loving each other and respecting each other and you know, just connecting with each other. So it's simple.
It's simple but effective. As someone that works for the UNNA in peace, where would you like to see the world go, even though it's very easy to feel very pessimistic?
I think going back to why the United Nations was created, it was created after the World War II. To make sure that there's no World War III that is going to ever happen. In a way, we were successful. I mean, we are successful in that. There's so many problems, as you know. The United Nations is made up of 193 countries and 6 agencies and all of that. So it's still doing its best. And we still believe in what it's doing. People are saying, what is it doing? It's not just about war. It's doing all these humanitarian services. So when all the war and everything is left, all the battles have been done, the UN stays behind to feed the poor, to heal the sick, you know, to do all the things that need to be done, to resettle the people and all of that. So it's, in a way, that is what we want to do, is to convince the world that the world that is a better place because the United Nations exists. So peace, I think my worldview is peace within yourself. I think if you are peaceful in yourself, it's the intrinsic value of you, yourself as a human being, then you will value each other. So it's not a worldwide view. It's a sort of a personal view that we're working for, is that intrinsic value in the human life.
That was Zenny Edwards, who is an architectural historian and the director of the United Nations of Australia Peace Program. That's all for the chat this week. If you like the show, you can subscribe to our podcast via SoundCloud or iTunes or from our website, which is 2ser.com/thechat. The show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER 107.3. I'll catch you next week.